First of all, thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here, and it's a really nice place, and I'm especially happy to be here because I know that you have an extraordinary expertise in Higgs phenomenology, so it's really a nice place to be to speak about this. As you see on the first slide, I'm going to speak about some kind of exotic Higgs phenomenology at Hadron Collider, but before starting, I would like to make a very short introduction. And to do this introduction, I would like to do a flashback in 94. And since in 94 I was not doing physics, I cannot remember what I was doing in 94, but I was definitely not doing physics. I opened the particle data booklet, the one coming from 94, at the first page of the top section, of the top quark section. And if you open this book at this page, you will see basically two numbers in the first column. The first number is this one, and you probably recognized it. It's at the time, in 94, it was the best fit of all indirect electric data for the top mass. And just below, of course, in 94, you will find the first top candidate's events coming from Tevatron. And if you look at these two numbers, I think the first comment is that these people, at the same time, theorists and experimentalists made a great job because these two numbers agree quite well. And the second comment I had was, why in 94 it was possible to predict the top mass with such a good precision, with order 10 GeV, and why it's not possible to predict the Higgs mass with such a good precision now in 2007. So the answer is probably trivial, but let's take a look at it. So in the standard model, the top mass is predicted not only, but mainly coming from the measurement of what you can call the raw parameter. And the raw parameter can be defined like this in the standard model, where here the CZ stands for the cosinus of the theta-Weinberg angle at the Z mass in the MS-bar normalization scheme. And if you define it like this, then it's one at Rydberg, but it's no longer equal to one at one group. And it's completely trivial to compute the contribution from a non-degenerate doublet of fermion, so top-bottom in this case. And you will see that this correction is essentially proportional to this expression. And this expression has the nice property to be equal to zero if the top mass and the bottom mass are equal. And if the bottom mass is going to zero, then you see that the correction to the raw parameter is essentially proportional to the square of the top mass. So this is for the top, and if you look at the same correction but coming from the X, the standard model X, then in this case the correction is, the first difference is that the correction is negative, so the largest the top mass is, the largest can the Higgs mass be, can be the Higgs mass. And the other difference is that this time the correction to the raw parameter is logarithmic. It's not longer quadratic in the Higgs mass, it's proportional to the log of the Higgs mass. And due to this, and this is the answer to my initial question, due to this, even if you vary quite a lot the Higgs mass between 60 GeV, which was probably the direct constraint at this time, and 1 TeV, which is close to be the unitarity limit, then you will see that the top mass is not varying so much. So if you measure the raw parameter with a fixed precision, you predict much better than the top mass than the Higgs mass. Okay. So the question is now why the correction to the raw parameter is not quadratic in the Higgs mass, because naively, if you compute the correction coming from a scalar to a gauge boson propagator, you would expect it to be quadratic, naively. And the answer is that if you look at the standard model scalar potential, so you all know the Higgs potential, if you look at this potential, it's trivial to show that this potential is invariant under a symmetry which is a little bit larger than the usual SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. It's a SU2 left cross SU2 right symmetry, which is equivalent to 0.04. And you can see this by writing, if you write phi as like this, with pi 1, pi 2, pi 3, the would be Gostone bosons, and you write down phi in terms of this real field, so we see that here you have something like the norm of a 4-vector in a 4-dimensional space, so you have a 0.04 invariance, and if sigma 0 is going to get the VEF, then obviously the O4 is broken to O3, which is the vectorial part of the original Galois SU2 left plus SU2 right. And under this O3 symmetry, the Wolbe Goldstone bosons pi 1, pi 2, pi 3 transform as a triplet. And the consequence of this is that if you look at the definition of the rho parameter, you have here the mass of the W plus the W minus. Here it's essentially the mass of the W3. So due to the fact that the Wolbe Goldstone bosons are grouped in a triplet, while the mass of this guy is related to the mass of this guy, and the rho parameter is close to 1 coming from scalar correction, due to scalar corrections. Okay, he skipped. So, but of course, if you look at the other sector of the other sectors of the theory, like the gauge sector and the Yukawa sector, you will see that crystallic symmetry is broken in the standard model. And in the gauge sector, it's obvious to realize why it's broken. In fact, if you look at this trigger-like mass relation between the mass of the W and the mass of the Z, you will see that you recover a triplet of degenerate gauge bosons only in the limit where gy is sent to zero, then in this case the mass of the W and the mass of the Z are equal, but if you send g left to zero, then you have the mass of the W which is zero, and the W is massless and degenerate with the photon. So in both limits where gy is going to zero and g left is going to zero, you recover a crystallic symmetry. And obviously the Yukawa sector also breaks the SU2 left plus SU2 right, as you all know, because the Yukawa couplings for down-type quarks and up-type quarks are not the same, so you cannot write on a term which is invariant under SU2 left plus SU2 right. Okay, so this was for the introduction. So the outline of my talk today, I would like first to introduce what is a two-exhibit model first, and how to define a generic crystallic symmetry in a two-exhibit model, and how to define in particular a twisted crystallic symmetry. Then I will end up with some a kind of dog model, a restricted version of the scalar potential, and I will try to constrain the model with direct constraint and direct constraint, and also some theoretical constraints, and I will end up with the associated phenomenology at colliders, which is probably the most important, most interesting part for you. Okay. So first, let's take a look at the generic two-exhibit model. An easy way to widen the most generic two-exhibit model you can imagine is to define four emission operators like this. So with phi 1 and phi 2 to its doublets, you can write down A, which is phi 1 square, B, which is phi 2 square, and then you define the real part and the imaginary part of phi 1 dagger phi 2, and you define them as being C and D. Okay? And since you have four emission operators, you can write down the generic two-exhibit model potential as being the four linear terms in A, B, C, and D, and then the 10 quadratic terms in A, B, C, and D. And you obtain at the end, right, it's trivial to do, and you obtain at the end 14 parameters. Okay. Okay. So an interesting property of the two-exhibit model potential is that you have some additional freedom, which is a rho parameterization freedom, if you rotate phi 1 and phi 2 using a unitary 2 by 2 rotation, and that you will define accordingly all the coefficients appearing in the potential, then the physics will not change. And well, there has been a lot of paper written on the subject of basis invariants, but probably this one is one of the first one. And you can use this basis invariants to go to the Higgs basis, the so-called Higgs basis, where only one of the two Higgs doublets is going to get a vacuum expectation value. So you use this unitary 2 by 2 rotation to rotate phi 1 and phi 2 in such a way that only phi 1 is going to have a VEF. Okay? If you do this, then it's quite easy to understand that if you want to define a generic crystallic symmetry, the only requirement you have to impose is that SU2 left plus SU2 right acts on M1. M1 is the 2 by 2 representation of phi 1, so you write down M1 like this in terms of the real field appearing in phi 1, and the SU2 left plus SU2 right symmetry acts like this on M1, and if you define only this transformation for M1 is already sufficient to get the raw parameter equal to 1 for what is regarding the scalar correction, because all the Goldstone bosons are grouped in phi 1, since only phi 1 is going to develop a VEF. Okay? So since all Goldstone bosons are grouped in phi 1, this is already sufficient to ensure that rho is equal to 1. And now you can ask the question on what happens to phi 2. And since only SU2 left cross U1y, so no SU2 right, but U1y is a local gauge symmetry, then the right transformation of M2 is not completely fixed. You have some freedom on the right transformation you impose on M2, which is the 2x2 representation of phi2. So I'm not going to write down here Uy, I'm going to write down Vr, and you can show that if you want to keep U1y unbroken, the most generic choice you can have for Vr is a rotation of the unitary matrix Ur with some diagonal matrix X with some unfixed phase gamma. Okay? So we have some additional freedom coming from the presence of this unfixed phase gamma. And if you do this, so if you define this generic Custodial symmetry and that you impose this generic Custodial symmetry on your potential, then it's trivial to show that only A and B are invariant, but also this combination C prime, which is a combination of C and D, where you see that in this combination appears gamma, this combination is also invariant under the generic Custodial symmetry, and no other term is invariant. So if you impose it, you end up with 9 free parameters, because you have to build your potential with only 3 emission operators and not 4 emission operators. Okay. So now let's take a look at how you can define the CP transformation in the generic 2-exabit model. So you can choose this transformation. It's not the most generic choice you can do in a fixed basis, but you can show that if you do any other, if you select any other possibility, then basically the conclusion will not change. So let's choose this one. So phi 1 transform as phi 1 star, and phi 2 transform as phi 2 star. So the most generic one, you have some unknown phase here, but let's select this phase to be 0. And if you fix this CP transformation like this, and if you impose the potential to PCP invariant, and I impose it to PCP invariant just because it's easier to discuss the phenomenology, but you could imagine to do not impose it, but let's assume that we impose it to be CP invariant, then A, B, and C are CP even, it's trivial to show, and D, so the imaginary part of phi 1 negative phi 2, is CP odd, and if you impose explicitly the CP invariance, you end up with 10 free parameters, 9 coming from the other combination of A, B, and C, and you also have D squared, since D is CP odd. So the question is, what happens if you impose at the same time the CP and the Custodial symmetry? And the answer is that basically you end up with 2 non-trivial possibilities. The first one is, let's call it the usual Custodial symmetry, is you choose gamma is equal to 0. So in this case, the right rotation is the same for phi 1 and phi 2. Okay? It is the usual scenario where the SU2 left cross SU2 symmetry is the same for M1 and M2. In this case, if you impose the Custodial symmetry, you get the invariance under CP for free, just because the emission operator C prime, which is invariant under the Custodial symmetry, is in this case C, and C is CP even, so you do not need to impose anymore the CP invariance. You always get it from free from the Custodial symmetry. And the phenomenological signature of this is a degenerate SU2 vectorial triplet H plus H minus and A0, and two singlets H0 and capital H0, which can eventually mix. And well, it's quite easy to realize that this is the limit of MSSM in the case where G left is going to 0, because in the MSSM you have this mass relation, and you see that you end up with some degeneracy between H plus H minus and A0 in the limit where the mass of the W is going to 0, or in the limit where you remove all the D-terms in the D-terms in the sense of Suzy, all the D-terms in the MSSM stereo sector. Okay, the other possibility is what let's call it twisted custodial symmetry, is you impose gamma is equal to pi. So you have some minus sign, you have some pi phase between the right rotation of M1 and the right rotation of M2. In this case, you can show that you have to impose custodial and CP symmetry at the same time, just because this time C prime, so the term which is invariant under the custodial symmetry, is equal to D, and D is not CP even, it's CP odd. So if you just impose a custodial symmetry, your potential is not CP invariant. So if you impose it to be also CP invariant, you end up with 6 free parameters instead of 9. And in this case, the phenomenological signature of such a symmetry is that you have a degenerate triplet of two charged scalars and one CP even scalar, which is capital H0, and two orthogonal singlets H0 and A0, and the standard model H0 cannot mix anymore with A0 because H0 is CP even and A0 is CP odd. So you have a strictly standard model like Higgs boson. Okay, and the last point is the Z2 symmetry. So you probably all know that for a generic Z2X Lebesgue model, in general, people are imposing a Z2 symmetry to avoid flavor-changing neutral currents. So if you impose this Z2 symmetry, So first of all, if you impose the twisted custodial and the CP symmetry, the potential that you are going to obtain is so restricted that you already have a Z2 symmetry for free. But the important point is that you get this Z2 symmetry in the Higgs basis. You do not get it in a generic basis where phi1 and phi2 both get a VEF. You get it in the specific basis, which is called the Higgs basis. And due to this, the Z2 symmetry remains unbroken. But what we would like to do is to define the Yukawa couplings in a generic basis. What we would like to do is to give the possibility to H1 and H2 to couple to fermions. So what I'm going to do is to assume that you have some additional horizontal SO2 or Pacheco-Quinn, whatever, symmetry, so that this Z2 symmetry, which is exact in the Higgs basis, remains at most softly broken in any basis. So if you rotate phi1 and phi2 with some unitary rotation, I would like the Z2 symmetry to remain at most softly broken. Okay, and if you do all the step, basically you end up with such a potential that you can write like this. And in this case, H1 and H2 are defined in a generic basis where H1 gets a vacuum expectation value V1 and H2 gets a vacuum expectation value V2. And like usual, you define tangent beta as being V2 over V1. And okay, with this potential, it's quite easy to compute the mass spectrum associated with it. And you see that basically you have a standard model X here with some mass which is essentially the same as in the standard model. You have a degenerate triplet of capital H0 and the charge X with a mass which is proportional to the Z2 breaking term mu12 over sine 2 beta. And let's define the mass of these guys as being mt squared. And you also have a pseudo scalar, which this time is not degenerate with the charge X, but which is equal to the mass of this guy minus some term which could be arbitrarily large. So the A0 can be as light or as heavy as you want compared to the charges. Okay, so also, as you probably know, in a 2xLebesgue model, usually people define two kinds of 2xLebesgue model, type 1 and type 2, depending on how you define the transformation of fermions under the Z2 symmetry. If you define all fermions to be Z2 even, in this case, you can only couple H1 to fermions, to down-type and up-type fermions. And the consequence of this is that, A0 has standard model-like couplings, so proportional to the mass of the fermions over V, while all the other couplings are scaled by some tangent beta factor. So this is type 1 model. And if you send tangent beta to 0, basically you recover what is called the inner doublet model, and this is useful for that matter because in this case all these guys are not coupling anymore to matter, and you have some, the lightest one is a good dark matter candidate. Okay, the other possibility is what people usually call a type 2. In this case, fermions are Z2 even, but uptight fermions are Z2 odd, then H1 is coupling to downtype and H2 is going to couple to uptype. And the consequence of this is that you have some MSSM like scenario, so H0 is still standard model like, but in this case, H0, A0, and H plus H minus are coupling with some. The coupling is carried by some factor tangent beta or cotangent beta, depending if you consider downtype or uptype fermions. Okay, so at the end of this first section, what you have basically is four free parameters: the mass of the Higgs, the mass of the triplet, the mass of the pseudoscalar, and tangent beta. And the question is, how can you choose them? And to choose them, just to make the phenomenological analysis at Collider easier, we are going to consider direct and indirect constraints. Okay. So the first thing before considering constraints is that we are going to make an hypothesis, and this hypothesis is that the A0 is the lightest one. Okay, it's just a pure hypothesis. There is no particular theoretical reason to consider the A0 as being the lightest one, but you are free to do it in this scenario. So let's assume that A0 is the lightest one. And okay, of course, you have some theoretical constraints, like usual, on the exponential. So you have to assume that the quartic term lambda s is bigger than 0, and that the quartic term lambda s is also bigger than the quartic term lambda as, so that if you look at very large semi-classical values of phi 1 and phi 2, your potential is well behaved. For the unitary constraint, well, you can show that if you compute the X scattering matrices and you compute the eigenvalues of this matrix, you end up with constraint of lambda s and lambda as, which are essentially this one. And for the perturbativity, in principle, what you should do is to write down the randomization group equation for lambda s and lambda as, and to expand the beta function and to look if everything is fine, so that each term in the Taylor expansion is well smaller than the previous one. But you can show that a very conservative choice is something like lambda s or lambda s is smaller than pi. Sometimes people are taking 2 pi or 4 pi, or it depends, but you can show that pi is a rather conservative choice. And with all these constraints, you end up with these constraints on the masses. So the mass of the standard model X must be bigger than the gap between the mass of the charge X and the mass of the pseudoscalar. And the second constraint is that the mass of the X must be smaller than 500 GeV. This is coming essentially from the very strong constraint of perturbativity here. Okay, so now you
could. Just
yeah.
Go back once more.
Sure.
To that last okay.
So, for what is regarding the raw parameter, if you impose the exact twisted custodial symmetry, of course you end up with a standard model like correction, so all corrections coming from additional X's. Are zero, so you only have something which is proportional to the log of the standard model X, and you have some constraint on the standard model X mass, which is something like 250 GeV. And what you could assume is that the twisted custodial symmetry is slightly broken, and if it happened that these two guys are close but not exactly degenerate, then these terms, which is quadratic, would compensate for a large curve coming from the Higgs mass, and I think that you have been the first to consider this in this paper in 2000. But in our scenario, you typically we consider much lighter masses than you were considering. Okay, and this is what I was saying. So in our scenario, we are going to consider quite low masses for the mass of the charge X and the mass of the capital H0, at least in type 1. And what you can show is that you can accommodate something like 350 GeV for the mass of the standard model X if you allow for 10% breaking of the twisted custodial symmetry. Okay, so, well, you can also look at B physics, and the B0, B0 bar mixing is going to give you constraint on the coupling of the charge X to B and top. And essentially what we are going to do is, again, kind of conservative approach. So we are going to assume that the Chalcic contribution is within the experimental error. So we are going to assume that all parameters entering in the computation of this box diagram are very well known, and that the Chalcic contribution must be smaller than the current experimental error. So it's probably too constraining, but let's assume that you do this. Then you end up with constraint on total beta, which is essentially 0.3 in type 1 and 5 to 10 in type 2, if the mass of the charges is more than 300 GeV. Otherwise, you can show that the contribution is negligible. The BS gamma decay, which is well known to be one of the most important constraints on type 2, here again, we are going to make some conservative approach. We are going to adjust all parameters so that you recover the best standard model prediction if you send the mass of the charge X to infinity. And if you do this, typically you obtain a constraint in type 1 which is weaker than V0 bar, but in type 2, this is a quite well known result, you have to impose that the mass of the charge X is very high, above 300 GeV. So muon G minus 2, so this is also an indirect constraint that you should consider. So of course it's not relevant in type 1 because here you only have leptons, so if you do not enhance the coupling which is here, then this diagram is not relevant. But in type 2 it could be relevant, and you can show that the 3 sigma discrepancy between the data and between the standard model prediction and the current data could be accommodated by a pseudoscalar which is around 20 GeV and a torsion beta around 30. And in fact, if you have such a pseudoscalar, well, moderately light, then this one are negligible. The one which is really contributing is the two diagram which is there, because these two diagrams only contribute if the mass of the scalar is of the order of 1 GeV. If you have a scalar for the 10 GeV, then the two contribution is bigger. Okay, the final and direct constraint I would like to consider is the ZBB bar vertex measured at left. And you can show again that it's not relevant in type 1 because you are coupling to bottom quarks, or at least for this one. And what you can show is that if you select a quite very large value of tangent beta, then in this case, you cannot have a too large mass gap between the A0 and the capital H0. So in particular, if you select a capital H0 which is bigger than 300, to be consistent with the BS gamma constraint, then the mass of the A must be bigger than 50 GeV. And for what is regarding the mass of the charges, you can show that it's less constraining than BS gamma. Okay, so the last constraints I'm going to consider are the direct constraints from colliders. So the first one is a constraint on the standard model Higgs. So we are going to assume that this bond on the standard model Higgs mass is the right one, even if you could imagine that the standard model Higgs is going to decay into something like two pseudoscalar, and in this case, this bond can be modified. This is also something which has been considered previously. We are also going to consider that the mass of the capital H0 plus the mass of the A0 is bigger than 150 GeV. In fact, usually people in SUSY are considering 180 GeV, but this bound only applies when the mass of the capital H0 and the mass of the A0 are nearly degenerated. If the mass of the A is much smaller, then in this case, you can show that you can lower the bound due to a bad signal selection. And we are also going to consider that the mass of the charge X and tangent beta are such that the branching ratio of top into charge X times the branching ratio of the charge X into two jets or tau nu tau is smaller than 30%, which is more or less the current Evetton constraint. So the two scenarios we are going to select as benchmark point for the phenomenology are, first of all, one benchmark in type 1 with tangent beta close to 0.2, a pseudoscalar which is something between 10 GeV and 100 GeV, a mass of the triplet which is just above the A0Z threshold, so that the capital H0 can decay into Z0A0, or the H plus can decay into WA, and the mass of the triplet is smaller than the mass of the X, which is close to be 300 GeV. And the other benchmark point is in type 2 with a tangential beta around 30 GeV. Then in this case, we select a 0 which is not too high to avoid the ZBB bar constraint, so between 100 and 300. And the mass of the triplet around 200 GeV to be fine with BS gamma. And the mass of the standard model is somewhere between the two. Okay. So the last point, which is probably the most interesting one, is the phenomenology at collider. So the first decay that could be interesting is the decay of A0 into A0, A0. And in this case, we can have a branching ratio as high as 1. And we are going to assume here the usual branching ratio for A into BB bar, so something around 90%. You could also have A0 into capital A0, capital A0, or H plus H minus, so it's already a little bit more exotic. And you can show that these decay are kinematically allowed, have typical branching ratio of order 20 to 30%. And the last point is that you could also consider that the charge X is going to WA, and the capital A0 is going to Z0A, and you can show that both these decays have branching ratio close to 1 if they are kinematically allowed. So the possible signal is coming from this decay. First of all, you could imagine that you produce a standard Mendel Higgs with the usual standard Mendel Higgs production signals, the standard model production, and you decay this standard Mendel Higgs into 2A0 or capital A0, capital A0, or H plus H minus, and you end up with typical signals with 0 to 2 W's or Z's and 4 V's, or eventually tau. In type 1, you could also imagine to produce the charge X in direct production with some tops, or in top decay, or in associated production with tops, and to decay the charge X in WA, and you end up with some standard top events with 2 Bs. And the last one, in type 2, you could imagine that you produce the capital A0 in associated production with BB bar, and decay the A0 into Z0, A0, and then you end up with 1 Z and 4 B final states. Okay, so typically you have an exotic model, and you also have quite populated final states. So if you want to go to your best experimentalist friend and ask him to do a full analysis of this, you need some Monte Carlo study of your model. And at the time we were discussing this model, there was a need for a new Monte Carlo tool because it was not possible to study completely an exotic model, a really exotic model, and a populated final state with only one tool at this time. So we were thinking about developing a new version for MatGraph, and this new version has been released officially 1 month ago now. To go quickly to the new thing in MatGraph version 4, basically you have new models. So you have the Higgs effective field theory, you have, the MSSM was already there, but you also have the 2x the bet model in a fully generic way, but I'm going to speak about this after. And the most important part is that you have no framework to define your own model, which is called the user mod. We also have a matching procedure between the matrix element description in MatGraph and the pattern shower in PTR and Airwick. We have something that should be called a user-friendly interface with some online event generation, some configuration with text files, calculator tools, and online analysis tools. And also the most important is that more is already coming. So we are working on something which is called Feynman rules, which is a Mathematica package to widen the Feynman rules starting from the Lagrangian. So for the moment, you need to have all the Feynman rules to implement your new model, but we are thinking about starting directly from the Lagrangian instead of starting from the Feynman rules. We are also working on decay chains to be able to tell MatGraph to simulate very complex decay chains in the narrow width approximation. We are working on some matrix element techniques for experimentalists, so for signal detections mainly. And we are also working on a new fast simulation tool. So for what is regarding the generic 2x the bet model in MatGraph version 4, so we have not implemented this very restricted model. We have implemented the generic 2x the bet model, and we have implemented the 2x the bet model with CP variation and with flavor changing natural current. And all these things are available on the web. You can use a calculator working both in generic and its basis. And if you really look at one signal in any Higgs phenomenology, I think it's enough to reproduce any kind of signal for any kind of Higgs phenomenology. I mean, not to, of course, not enough to reproduce all the phenomenology, but to reproduce a particular signal, at least at Hadron colliders. Okay, so now I'm going to review, well, to come back briefly on all the signals I were discussing. So the first one is unusual top decay into charge XB, and the charge X going to WA. Then you end up with essentially two W's, and so there's two W and there's two B's coming from the top, plus two extra B's. So you can show that the signal at LHC is around 10 picobound for this, and 0.1 picobound at TEVAT1, and typically the signals have been studied by Roy Nigelborg in a recent paper. If the mass of the charge X is larger than 160 GeV, then you expect it to be produced in associated production with top, and then the final state, if you allow H plus to go into WA, you end up with two W's and three B's, and this is 0.5 picobound at LHC. And the main background to this signal is TT bar plus NJET, and of course it's even irreducible if the gluon is decaying to BB bar. So the other one that you could consider is AGO going to AA, and there has been many studies, and in particular, well, there has been a study at TEP on this, just so you know. And AGO is, in this case, you can show that if you have a W, probably the easiest choice is to take one of the A going to to Toto and the other one going to BB bar. So if you assume that AGO is going to A0, you could even select the 4B final state at TEVAT1, and there has been a paper on this also recently showing that in fact it's feasible only if you have some enhanced production compared to the SM, so typically a type 2 with large tangent beta. You could imagine to have an associated production of X with Z or with W, then you have Z plus 4B, and this could be feasible at LHC for a light A0. This is also the subject of a recent paper. And the 2B2 final state may be also interesting at LHC, both in associated production with Z or even in vector boson fusion. Okay, and the last signal, which is probably, let's say, the golden signal at LHC for this kind of mass spectrum, is the direct production of the standard harmonics going to 2 capital A0, and this capital A0 going to A0Z, and A0 going to B, so you end up with 2Z's and 4B's final state, and you end up with something like cross-section of around 1 picobar, which is huge compared to the typical background, which is 2Z plus jets. You could also imagine to produce the capital A0 in association with B's, then you end up with Z4B final state, with a cross-section around 5 picobar at LHC. And you could even imagine to produce this capital A0 at TEVAT1 and to look at the Z2B final state. And this is something probably people at TEVAT1 are going to look at. And you can show that all these signals are very low standard body background because typically you have Z plus jet and 2Z plus jets, which are very low backgrounds in the standard model. So these are quite challenging analyses. First of all, because the backgrounds must be simulated very carefully, so you need to generate TG bar plus jets, Z plus jets, and W plus jet background, and to simulate them carefully with matching. And the other point is that the B's produced in light A0 decay could be potentially highly boosted if they are coming from a heavy object. And the question, how well can you take super B jets, so two B jets which are very close, one from each other, are you going to tag them as one B jet, or are you going to tag them as two B jets, or is the efficiency going to be the same if you have two B jets or one B jet? Well, you have a lot of experimental questions there which are not really solved, at least at LHC. And the question, can the mass of the A0 be measured, is not solved neither for low masses. And also, we were thinking about using maybe some matrix element techniques, but this is probably hopeless, in fact. So the conclusion.
So matrix element
techniques in the experimental context. I mean, like they have used, for example, for measuring the top mass at Tevatron.
Yeah, but here you're talking about isolating events.
Yeah. So knowing the exact matrix element, I mean, you have to assume that you know the model behind.
Mm-hmm.
And if you assume that you know the model behind, you can try to give more weight to some events. So the conclusion is essentially that I believe that in some sense a custodial symmetry, or at least a not too badly broken custodial symmetry, is necessary in the big sector, and in order for it to be natural, and a twisted realization of this custodial symmetry exists. A two exhibit model with a twisted custodial symmetry can be variable, and you end up with some unusual and challenging phenomenology at Hadron Collider. And if you look at the perspective for this, well, the first one is obviously to look, nobody really believes that the two-exhibit model is going to be the end of the story. So if you look at larger models, like a model with light strongly interacting Higgs, or little Higgs model, or stuff like this, if you look at these models where typically you end up with a two-exhibit model, if you impose that the symmetry is not the usual one, but the twisted one, the twisted custodial symmetry at the end, what will be the consequence for the more ambitious model you are considering? Also, what we would like to do, and people are already starting to do this, is to do some full simulation of the most important signals, like 2Z4Bs, and some detailed studies of this at TVAT1. And I think the last important message is that, whatever this scenario, or whatever the fact that it's more or less a top model more than something really realistic, I think the important message is that the X phenomenology does not always reduce to standard model, MSSM, or even an MSSM-like scenarios. You could have some more exotic possibilities, and we should all stay open to them. Thank you for your attention.
So, questions? Well, I have one question.
Sure.
Are you aware of any supersymmetric models that do have a choice for, gut scale parameters or whatever?
Yeah.
No.
It's I'm not aware of such a case. And the main reason is that to go to a twisted case, we should remove terms in the superpotential.
Yes.
It's not that you should add some terms. I mean, you could imagine to have some Carrier potential adding some terms, but it's hard to tune all these things such that you remove the term that you do not want to have. So typically the phi 1, phi 2 plus phi 2, phi 1 term, which is difficult to remove in theory.
Yeah.
So I discussed this. Yeah, I do not know. I mean, it could happen, but I do not know yet.
Other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Mikhail again.